During this holiday season, we've been asking about your favorite holiday foods, and you've sent us notes about dishes like menudo, wassail, ambrosia, and today we turn to Eastern Europe for a cake that is served on New Year's Eve. Reporter Sasha Woodruff tells us about the four-layer rum-soaked tradition.
To celebrate the New Year for as long as I can remember, my mom has baked a cake called a Punschtort, or as she says it, Punschtorte. It was a tradition started in my mom's family back in the former Czechoslovakia.
At midnight, we pour champagne and had a toast to New Year's, and then we hugged and kissed each other, drank our champagne, and then we ate cold cuts, potato salad, and after that, we had the cake with a little bit of coffee.
It's a pink glazed sponge cake with layers soaked in a rum and citrus syrup. It all starts out with 16, yes, 16 eggs.
8 eggs for the basic dough, and then 8 eggs for the dough we divide in half. Half of it we make pink, and half of we put a cocoa in it, and we make it brown.
You start by separating the yolks from the whites, mixing 3 different cake batters, one white, one pink, one brown. The tradition of serving up this pink glazed tort goes back to my great-grandmother's kitchen in the early 1900s. She ran a restaurant in the next town over, but at home, she made all sorts of extravagant creations without the help of modern machinery.
Well, she made this very similar, except she would blend it and beat it all by hand.
My mother learned to make this cake as a young girl. She was born during the Second World War, and food was scarce. But my family was fortunate enough to have a sprawling garden, so the 16 eggs were a luxury they could afford.
We had chickens and we had goats for milk during the war when they were bombing the town. And so we were able to eat them and enjoy it.
Some of the other ingredients weren't so easy to come by. The cake soaks in a rum punch, which calls for the juice of one lemon and one orange. Finding citrus in this former communist country required both patience and connections.
If you got a one lemon or for a tea, we had to stand in a line for it for 2-3 hours. And if there was news that in this little vegetable store there would be lemons next day, somebody secretly told somebody, and then everybody spread it between their friends, and then everybody lined up in front of the store and waited.
Once the lemons and oranges were acquired, they were squeezed into a cooked sugar syrup. The pink and chocolate cakes were cut into concentric rings and reassembled to look like bullseyes. The layers were stacked on top of each other and the syrup spooned over top. Then, a 24-hour wait. The next day, the cake was glazed with a pink lemon frosting. In the 1940s and 50s, food dyes were not available, but my great-grandmother had a stash hidden away.
She called the food coloring Breton, and I don't know if it's from Bretagne, from France, or where she was able to buy it, but I know these luxurious things after the war and after the communists took over, they were not available, but a lot of the stuff my grandmother had left from the hotel and the restaurants we had, and we were so excited just to see that lovely pink cake.
For me, the bubblegum-colored frosting isn't the best part of this cake. It's when you cut into it. Thanks to those concentric circles, a dazzling checkerboard appears in each slice. It's best enjoyed with a glass of champagne. For NPR, I'm Sasha Woodruff.
And you can find the recipe for Punschtort and other unique holiday foods at npr.org. 2011 was a lousy year for a lot of businesses and many people seeking work. It was also, for some companies, a very good year, and that includes IBM, which turned 100 in June, and which is one of the success stories we're following this week. IBM stock climbed this year even more than Google and Apple. NPR's Ben Bergman explains why.
Don't just take my word for it. Here's what Warren Buffett announced on CNBC last month.
We bought about $10.7 billion worth of one stock, IBM.
You've bought over $10 billion in IBM?
Buffett's bet was surprising because he normally doesn't go near tech stocks, and no one was more surprised than IBM.
The company's finding out right now that you own 5% of the company?
Five and a half percent.
By you talking about this right now?
Right, I've not talked to the company.
So how did the third richest man in the world discover IBM? Well, he says he got the annual report in the mail and spent a Saturday reading it. What impressed Buffett is how much IBM has moved away from being a computer company. IBM managing partner Adam Klaber points out that his company sold its PC business 6 years ago.
There is no such thing as an IBM PC, and I think that really defines how we look at evolving and innovating as a company. As we saw that we're moving towards the end of the PC-centric era and that we wanted to move forward.
83% of IBM's business now is services and software. Sign a contract with Big Blue and you get their consulting, their cloud computing, their servers, their analytics, even their financing. Bobby Cameron analyzes IBM for Forrester Research.
That's the game they're playing, where it's this broad set of technologies brought to bear, and it's very difficult for anyone else to pull all that together.
When the NYPD needed a system to track crime and better deploy cops, they hired IBM. When the telecom company Bharti Airtel wanted to build wireless coverage in 16 African countries, IBM. And why is this all-you-can-eat approach better than selling hardware? Because, as Cameron explains, being in the computer business just isn't very profitable anymore.
Over the last 15 years, the cost of an equivalent amount of computing has been reduced by a factor of 23, so it's 23 times cheaper. So a computer sale is no longer an individual component that all by itself can drive a lot of business value.
To find out what happened to companies that stuck to selling PCs, take a look at HP or Dell, which have seen their value plummet right alongside the price of computing. Meanwhile, IBM has become the one-stop shop of choice for many governments and companies.
Over the next 20 years, air traffic is expected to double. The systems that track, manage, and connect these flights weren't built to handle all that data. IBM's working with Boeing on a next-generation system to help integrate global air traffic more efficiently and in real time.
And more reasons investors are flying high on IBM? It's been aggressively building up its presence in the fastest-growing countries, China, Brazil, and India, where it says it will get 30% of its revenue in 4 years. In China alone, IBM has deployed 20,000 consultants. The company also named a well-liked new CEO who will take over next week, Virginia Rometty. Though its most famous employee still plugs into the wall.
What is Christchurch?
Yep.
Hedgehog Podge for $1,200.
That would be the supercomputer Watson playing Jeopardy in February.
The Hedgehog and the Fox is an essay on this Russian count's view of history. Watson?
Who is Leo Tolstoy?
Yes.
And yes, in case you hadn't heard, Watson crushed the competition, delivering IBM another win this year. Ben Bergman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
3 years ago, the government bailed out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the hybrid public-private mortgage institutions. Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times and her co-author Joshua Rosner wrote a book about them called Reckless Endangerment. We asked Morgenson about Fannie and Freddie today.
They are taxpayer-owned entities. The taxpayer has had to support them to the tune of $150 billion so far. That's by no means the end of the line. There will be further losses, undoubtedly. But what you're seeing now is the effects of the risky mortgages that these entities either purchased from banks and lenders or guaranteed.
The Securities and Exchange Commission last week accused six former officials, including former CEOs of Fannie and Freddie, of fraud, of assuring investors that their portfolio of bad loans was substantially smaller than it really was. What's the likely outcome, do you think, of those cases?
Well, as you know, the SEC rarely brings these cases to court. They generally settle. Usually it's a monetary settlement, a penalty of some kind. So I'm anticipating that that will be what happens here. It would be unfortunate because I think that it would be very interesting to see what comes out in a courtroom, in a trial, because then the American people will really have a far greater grasp of what these entities were doing.
Now, if you just go back to six former executives in these two large institutions, you're still not reaching back far enough to identify the people who set this thing in motion.
That's correct. A catastrophe this large cannot happen overnight. This really began in 1991 and 92 when Congress was considering legislation to protect the taxpayer for just these kinds of losses. At the moment, they were worried about the S&L crisis, which, as you remember, had arisen out of a lot of failed banks. They were worried that these kinds of losses might be in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's portfolio, and they wanted to craft legislation that would increase the strength of the regulator and that would increase the capital requirements of the companies, i.e. the money that they would have to set aside for a rainy day. But what happened was the company did everything it could and successfully defanged that legislation.
Why were they able to do that? How did that work?
It was a traditional lobbying effort in which they threw money at legislators. Both sides of the aisle received donations from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It was a political machine par excellence.
Now, is there any possibility of criminal prosecution for the losses at Fannie and Freddie? A lot of people did make a lot of money. Is there any chance that any of them will, you know, will have to take something more than a fine for what they've done?
A very little likelihood. Certainly the SEC is not allowed to bring criminal cases. They are not a criminal enforcement entity. You know, we have seen absolutely no indication that the Justice Department is investigating Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And, you know, if you want real perverse paradoxes, let's face the fact that the American taxpayer, because we own these entities, are actually paying the legal bills of the executives who are being sued now by the SEC.
Gretchen Morgenson, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Gretchen Morgenson is a reporter and columnist for the New York Times and is the author, with Joshua Rosner, of Reckless Endangerment: How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. This is NPR News. New Year's Eve means it's time for new resolutions. Commentator Frank DeFord has one in mind.
The New Year's Eve, we did the town. The day we tore the goalpost down.
Ah, we still do the town on New Year's Eve, but tearing the goalpost down is now verboten, deemed too dangerous. In fact, as our new year approaches, it's a good time to look back on several other things in sport that have long since faded away. Who remembers, for example, that at the end of each inning in the field, baseball players would just chuck their gloves onto the grass behind their position, leaving the field littered with mitts all game long? A lot of basketball courts were surrounded by chain-link fence. That's why basketball players were called cagers before they were called hoopsters. Professional golfers smoked as they walked the links. On the green, the golfer, I remember Arnold Palmer in particular, would line up his putt, smoking still, then throw the lighted cigarette aside, onto the green, putt, pick up a cigarette, inhale, and move on to the next tee. It all seemed very rakish and debonair at the time. Co-eds were called co-eds and had corsages pinned on them at football games. Baseball players wore stirrup socks, and basketball players wore short shorts. So a lot of things in sport, which seemed absolutely institutionalized as part of the game, did change. Yes, some alterations are merely stylistic. Others, though, are quite substantive. So, will the National Hockey League, especially Commissioner Gary Bettman, please take note? It's time in the year 2012 to do away with fighting in NHL games. Yes, some fans who grew up with it may like it and think it's a necessary part of the game. But it's anachronistic and idiotic, and players get hurt. The idea that you have special goons to battle each other while the game stops completely makes hockey seem hokey. If the NHL really believes that it needs staged fighting to succeed, then the people who run the NHL don't have much belief in the intrinsic worth in their sport as a sport. Let us hope that one day, very soon in the new year, that Commissioner Bettman simply announces that that's it. Starting tomorrow, fighting in hockey is against the rules, as it is in every other real sport. Then we could welcome ice hockey into the 21st century. Of course, it would also be nice to get short shorts back, too.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.